Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Welcome to Beyond Brunel. Today we're talking about inequality and what we can do as professionals to try and address it in the region. I'm joined by Peter Radford, Associate Director of Turner & Townsend Infrastructure, and Alicia de Haldevang, Sustainability and Equalities Principal Consultant at Stantec. It's such a pleasure to welcome you to the podcast today. Welcome both. Let's start off with a big question. And Peter, I'm going to come to you first. We know the Southwest is made up of a large rural population. So how does that impact inequality in the region?
Well, you're right, Chris. The Southwest is quite a mixed bag with an awful lot of remote rural communities, coastal communities. With that comes a risk of inequality, but that risk is enhanced with the sort of geography of the Southwest, where we've got arterial routes bringing goods, services and people back into the Southwest and away from east-west routes, but not much in the way of north-south routes. And those have been impacted in the past with previous decisions, cutting railways and so on. So we do have quite a few issues, and traditional industries, you know, we might talk about tin mining in Cornwall or shipbuilding in Plymouth. These things have changed over time. We had ports all over the Southwest, and now these things tend to be accumulated in certain locations like Bristol, Plymouth and Southampton, and all of those smaller ports and connectivity to the railway network, those things have disappeared. So we've had some real challenges in the Southwest, and it's left a legacy of significant inequality and deprivation by any measure. And of course, you know, we've seen it inward investment affected by that. When you've got challenges, the likelihood of investment from businesses who want to turn a profit, you know, because of the good transport links and so on, that might be impacted as well. So these things need collective action, but in the round, you know, there are lots of things to address.
Looking at the data and the questions we're not asking about it from a design perspective, you know, I work a lot in gender inequality and the spaces that we design. And there is a wonderful charity called Make Space for Girls, who I will continue to quote for forever. And they have come up with data and park watch and counts that show that 90% of facilities in the country, from a recent park watch count, are dominated by boys, who are 90% of the users. Now, with that data, do we just say, oh, tick, being used, they're busy? Or do we say, hang on, who isn't using it? And why are they not using it? And what are the repercussions of that? It's impacting girls' health, their exercise levels, their enjoyment of sport, their access to sport as well. And we need to go to the people who aren't covered in that data. It's also impacting boys who don't want to play football or go on a Mooga or go on a skate park or BMX track. But use that data to say, right, well, how do we change the spaces that we design so they benefit more people and other groups of society, rather than just keep churning out the same places and the same infrastructure that is actually just exacerbating the problem further?
So, Alicia, I'm going to come back to you and I'm going to ask you, how do we give those sorts of people a voice?
It might sound really simple, but we need to ask them. And we need to not rely on an equality impact assessment and make assumptions. We need to go to the groups and ask them what they need. And also, we need to remember that when we've asked one person from one group, we've spoken to one person from one group. And we can be so much better in our consultation process as well. Understand that when we're setting up a consultation, understand the limitations of the groups we are trying to reach, whether it's language, accessibility, venue as well, in terms of culture and religion, timing because of people working. So we cannot expect just have a consultation, a public hall in a town hall at 10 a.m. and expect everyone to turn up. Go to the communities. If the teenage girls aren't at the park, go to where they are and ask them why they aren't at the park and what do they want from a park instead.
I completely agree with that. It's funny, having worked in local government for many years, I got really tired of people telling me what the public thought. So I was involved in this thing. I chaired this thing called the National Highways Benchmarking Club at the time. And we did a poll of our membership. This was local authorities all over the country, and asked them what sort of thing might help. And they said, well, we all do public surveys. Yeah, we're all doing them differently at different times. And so anyway, that prompted the big idea of, hey, shouldn't there be a national survey for this? So we created the National Highways and Transport Survey. National Highways and Transport Network owns this survey. It was created in Taunton, I set up this conference at the cricket ground in Taunton. We had membership from all over Southwest, so it was really a Southwest creation, and it was standardizing how we asked the public about highways and transport and collecting demographics of the responses so that we could actually sift and cut and slice and dice in statisticians' parlance the data and understand where the responses were coming from, and then we could also map the results. This thing took off and it's now truly national, and it's reportedly the largest voluntary survey of any public services in the UK. And it was born in the Southwest, so I think we can be a bit proud of that. It's so important, and the public will have been telling us stuff for years. It's there. We need to learn from it and do stuff with it, and then ask again, you know, has it hit the mark? And then because we've done that, we can learn who's been doing stuff well and copy them. You know, there's real advantages in being joined up and consistent with these things.
So I think if we use baseline data, so in terms of if we're doing inequality impact assessment, we have the baseline data across particularly the protected characteristics in the Equality Act. We therefore then need to reach out, do a bit of a desktop exercise and understand who are the communities who represent those protected characteristics, who are their contacts, go and speak to them. What do they need? Where can we do better? The spaces that they live, why are they not serving them? So I think it's not a one exercise that will tick everything off. Just as I said, don't just go have a town hall meeting at 10 a.m. Have a town hall meeting at 10 a.m., but also have one at 6 p.m. when other people can turn up. Go to a school, go to a mosque, go to a church. Consultations are expensive, very time consuming, but the information you get is so important because it makes a difference about the places that we keep designing or the places that we design that have actually got the feedback from people as well. And also do it early within the design process. Going to a community saying, we have these plans, what are your thoughts? Is slightly imposing your thoughts on them rather than, we have an idea for this, what would you like from your space? Would you like to co-design it with us? That's going to get so much more buy-in than just big board saying, we're going to do this. How do you feel about it?
I can absolutely endorse that. I was involved in the Wells City Centre Enhancement, Wells being the smallest city in England, in a part of Somerset. We had what was called a Planning for Real event. This was 20 years ago, but we had the community and we set up shop in the high street in Wells. And we got such fantastic views in from the whole community, and that guided the design, and that was before the design was done, and it was such a benefit, and I think sort of borne out with the results of the work, you know. And it's such a pleasure as well, you know. I'm a civil engineer, and you know, working with the public is a pleasure. If you feel you've delivered the goods at the end of it, it's so much more professionally satisfying.
I think there's also an opportunity to show people, a lot of people don't know what they want unless you show them options. So if you show people some options that they could also have. There was a recent consultation exercise which was taking families from a poorer area, and they wanted to design their local park. So a whole group of families were then taken on a bus and got to see all these different other parks. And then at the end, they got to choose what do they want from every single one of them. So they have had to be able to design that. So they've been shown the opportunities and been allowed to make a decision on it.
That would be sort of transferable intelligence, wouldn't it? So once you've been gathering this information and determined what has really landed well and what's effective, and then that's intelligence that other people could use. Not to say that you wouldn't recommend doing appropriate surveys locally there as well, but you've got probably a better start point than if you haven't learned from others.
This is absolutely fascinating and great to hear you both speak so passionately. I guess to summarise then, we're trying to be inclusive as designers and engineers and infrastructure professionals, but we're not necessarily being inclusive in a way that we're approaching our engagement with the public, and equally in a way that we're obtaining feedback. In terms of that feedback that we receive, how do we use it going forward? How do we use it for our next project, our next big infrastructure scheme?
It's funny, I'm a great believer in sort of capturing things and making them accessible to others. And I spoke about this thing called the NHT survey. So I chaired it nationally for its first 8 years. And we used to have a conference every year in London at the ICE. And I, being the chair, I got privy sight of the survey results. And we could see certain authorities' performance just whizzing up the poll, and we could see they're doing well. What have they done? And so I used to pick up the phone and speak to their team leaders or whoever in road safety, buses, whatever discipline it was. And they'd say, oh my goodness, have the public noticed? Yeah, we did this and we did that. And there were usually really good nuggets of information, insight. And so we used to get that person, or, you know, maybe accompanied by a local politician, to the IC to stand up in front of the membership of the National Highways and Transport Network and tell them how they did it. And we captured those PowerPoint presentations and case studies and made them available to everyone. And I know quite a few people sort of copied the good practice and replicated good ideas. And that's the thing, you know, I mean, the great thing about professional bodies like the IC, there's a ready-made place to capture, share, and learn from information. And it's a journey, isn't it? You know, you sort of see t-shirts at the Olympics in 2012 when we went with our kids, and Better Never Stops was a t-shirt that I particularly liked. It doesn't stop. It's, you know, we're constantly learning, and change has been quite dramatic, particularly lately in the light of COVID.
I think in terms of design teams, so I come at it from a design engineering firm, is that having the lessons learned at every project. I think it's very easy, and I've experienced as well, that we complete a project, tick, 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 well done, get paid, off to the next one. And then the same things keep cropping up, and we're not applying the same lens to a new project. And this is not to talk us out of the job here. Inequality, equality is a fundamental component of social sustainability within the wider sustainability conversation. And I think it's the responsibility of, I mean, everyone's really, to uphold sustainable values. And it's encouraging more people within the design team to understand that and then have the confidence to bring up those lessons learned as well in the next design meeting. So they don't need another me in the room to say, oh, hang on, you thought about the impacts on these people, that people are understanding it more and more, just to encourage that learning.
And I'm going to come to you both with this question, but it's really about who's responsible for addressing change in the Southwest. So, Alicia, perhaps I'll come to you first.
Saying everyone is a real cliche answer, but I think actually it's the designers in the room, it's the engineers, it's the sustainability officers, and the consultants. I think it is our responsibility. We have all this data information. We're the ones who are building these places. So I think it's our responsibility to push and drive further change. There are lots of places. I spend a lot of time on Google Earth, traveling around going, gosh, that's a terrible place. Who would want to live there? These places are policy compliant, which we need to remember that. So how do we go above and beyond and really understand the impact of the places that we design, and how do we keep making them better and better? So when we turn up in a PowerPoint and we say, this is a wonderful place, we designed this, and it's excellent because of this, 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 it goes above and beyond. How does that then become normal? Why do we have to keep showing them as exemplar sites?
And Peter, how about you? You know, whose responsibility is it to address equality in the Southwest?
I'm a great believer in empowering people. And if you give people the right information, engineers are good at this stuff. You know, you give people insights into issues and they can go out and fix them. But if they don't have necessarily the insights, then they're not consistent. And if I could just mention an initiative I'm working on at the moment with colleagues, it's called IBIS. It's Infrastructure Benefits Insight Service. And it's basically, we're trying to look at tracking progress of inequality, including using deprivation indices, and trying to understand the circumstances of place. And the idea is that wouldn't it be great if everyone had access to this consistent information and can see exactly the point Alicia was making, you know, that some places really are desperately challenged. Inequality can be profoundly local, and you only have to look at deprivation statistics to see that. It's your local scheme. It might be retrofitting insulation in houses, it might be a bus scheme, it might be an active travel cycling scheme. You know, the provisions that could be implemented to make people's lives better can be really, really local. And it's the engineer on the ground out there meeting the public, taking views. And I think that's where I'd like to see the empowerment, and with it, responsibility. And so that, you know, everyone understands the inequality issue at grassroots level, and is empowered to do things about it. And I think we could see some quite significant changes if that were the case.
An impact on inequality that I haven't mentioned, but it's something that I will also not stop talking about, toilets. So no one's talking about the issue of public toilets, although I did see a news clip about the Southwest, about the issue of public toilets and things closing down, which I was overjoyed to see. And the impact that that is having on so many groups of society. I am an able-bodied person, but I have a hidden disability. I have a radar key. I cannot leave my house without planning a route, which is incredibly exhausting and stressful. And when we've lost 50% of public toilets in the last decade, that's even more stressful to then try and plan if I go somewhere new. People are dehydrating themselves on purpose because of it. And yes, they get shut down because of costs, but it costs 60 to 80 grand a year to look after, to maintain a public toilet, but it costs £950,000 a year to clean up the mess on the streets caused by the lack of toilets. So we fundamentally need to build them. And make sure that when I talked about placemaking and why do people like going to their places, because it's green space, because they've got their amenities, they've got the shops. If we don't have public amenities like public toilets, we are forcing people to stay at home and not go to the places that we design. So I will talk about it all the time. Vote me in as Minister of Toilets for life, because no one is doing anything about it. And I will do it for life. And we just need to build them. And every master plan I come up to, I say, where are the toilets? Oh, we haven't thought about that. Why have we not thought about it? So I'll keep talking about it.
I totally agree. It's part of civic society, isn't it? And the Victorians understood that. And the number of beautiful old welcoming places, you know, the Edwardian toilets that we've lost in the last 10 years or so is just profound. And obviously, it's down to the local authority, their budgets. It would seem an easy thing to cut, but the profound effect on communities, as you say, people who just were inhibited from going out, you know, we need to understand these things and act on them and make proper assessments about what's value for money.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn, follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest.
Of course, there are so many different facets, though, of equality to consider. And I guess what I'm wondering going forward is, how do we make sure that we capture the ball?
Peter talked about that in terms of all the database that we have and the information that is readily available to share across design teams, councils, anyone who's interested in it.
And do you think those people are working effectively together at the moment, or is there more work to do?
I think there's more work to do. I think there's always more work to do on better collaboration. People in marketing won't appreciate this because we need to tell the good stories. But I think there is an opportunity to showcase where things haven't gone as well, but where we're looking to improve them. So we just have that accountability as well and transparency to say, we've gone back and assessed it. We've got the data from a post-evaluation survey. We've spoken to these people. We're going to change it and make things better.
And of course, we're so good at shouting about all the really good work we do, but perhaps not so good at recognising where we've fallen short. So that's a really important point, I guess, for our listeners. Peter, I'm interested, would policy changes help us as professionals to deliver social change?
Do you know, I think a lot of the policies are there, but I think it sometimes falls down in the practicality. And I think in terms of infrastructure, politicians need to maybe set the agenda. There's no reason why there shouldn't be local policies and strategies for doing things, you know, to suit what local people think. But I think having set the political agenda, and like I say, I don't think there's anyone who's against the equality agenda, then give professionals the tools to do the job. And that might include reopening toilets or reopening railway lines, doing rack repairs in schools with an eye on those schools that maybe need it most, that are lagging behind. Nothing can be all done at the same time. You know, that you need to prioritise. And maybe even just the prioritisation of some interventions and maintenance repairs ought to be mindful of the circumstances and the place that are on the list. Maybe we need to think about how we prioritise as well.
I think there's also a point about how the data will continue to change because of an impact of climate change as well, and the impact of climate change on our infrastructure. So we need to look at everything with a climate change lens. We cannot avoid it. It's here, and we've got to stop pretending it's not happening.
So I suppose, Alicia, that begs the question, can we be sustainable and equitable?
I think they're one and the same. Equality is part of social sustainability and social justice and opportunities. So I think with sustainability, we can get stuck in a carbon tunnel vision. We only think about carbon emissions, but it's such a wider, with the three pillars of social, economic, and environmental. So they are exactly the same, intertwined.
And all picked up in the UN Sustainable Development Goals. You know, we have a framework to sort of encourage us to drive improvements and changes. As Alicia says, Chris, you know, it's changing so quickly. We were talking about COVID earlier, and as a family, we got really into the COVID maps, you know, infection rates and so on, and these were being issued daily. And so a really important piece of the armory in terms of tackling COVID were clearly infection rates. And, you know, these were being updated really frequently, and really clever stuff was being done in sewage treatment farms to understand, get early warning of COVID rates increasing or changing. And yet with inequality, which is such a big issue, we're relying on maybe data sets that come out every few years. We need much more frequent and much better consistent information. And, you know, we need to track changes. And if we're seeing changes that are unwanted, you know, we're seeing downward trends in places, you know, you don't want to wait for 5 years for the next data set to confirm it. You want to be doing something about it now. And, you know, everyone talks about education being a silver bullet, which obviously it is. You want to be equipping people for the challenges of the future now. And, you know, infrastructure can often take years to come to fruition. You know, if you want people being a part of it and maybe having STEM qualifications and so on, yeah, keep track on these things. Refresh the data much more frequently.
And I'm sure we've all felt the pinch recently, our projects too. And so I guess, Alicia, the question is, where does equality fit into that project piece? How do we demonstrate to our clients? How do we demonstrate to the public? It's a really important issue, and we should be considering that as part of our project work.
Well, I'd say have someone like me in the room for a design team meeting. But I think it's then sharing our experiences of places as well and different groups of society, and get people to all talk around the table what they want from a place, their experiences of equality or inequality, and have as many voices and opinions in the room as much as possible.
And Peter, you spoke a little bit earlier about the power of infrastructure and the effect that that's had on our region, you know, cuts to the railways and so on. So what lessons can we take from the past and apply to the future?
In the past, we provided infrastructure, used insights to provide infrastructure that worked maybe, but we didn't maybe ask the public as much as we did. But now we do have data that can tell us stuff, and we need to ask the public as well. And the impact of changes, you know, we need to be alert to those. I was reading an article by Cambridge University, a Dr. Gemma Burgess, about the impact of COVID on digital deprivation and digital inequality. And the impact of these things, so there's this massive global event, and it's had quite a significant impact. Now, take a far-flung geography like we have in the Southwest with lots of rural communities. You know, digital connectivity is really important. And particularly maybe with the change working setup and people getting into offices less. And if you haven't got it, you can't maybe exploit the opportunities of new ways of working and so on. And the investments that are needed, I think, need to be helped in places where there just isn't what might be. A bit like the buses, you know, after the 1985 Transport Act, everyone crowding around the lucrative bus routes. You know, it shouldn't be down to mobile phone companies or fibre companies to decide where digital connectivity occurs. This ought to be strategic, and it ought to be supported in places where it's needed. And that comes down to political will and decision making and professionals providing the right advice.
So, Alicia, I'm conscious that much of the work we do in the region is on aging infrastructure. It's around renewals and replenishing. And so I wonder, is there as much scope to consider equality and consider social change as part of those projects as there might be for new projects?
Yes, I think absolutely there is. So I think the statistic is that 80% of our buildings that exist today will exist in 2050. So we have a responsibility to make sure that they are future-proofed. And with that, bring in that inequalities and assess the impacts of these buildings as well in our designs and retrofitting opportunities, but also looking at the people and the communities who are impacted by these buildings and what do they want from their space and how do we allocate the funding to make sure that we create more of an equitable level playing field.
Peter, have you got any examples where we're trying to improve equality in a region?
Well, take railways, for example. We all remember the Dawlish problem and how suddenly you realise the resilience of the southwest is pretty challenged. Cowley Bridge near Exeter and the southwest being cut off from strategic transport links. And of course, that prompted discussion about other transport links and maybe people looking at previous closed railway lines. And recent discussion I had with Miranda Housden, IC's southwest director, about the Oakhampton line. So I think partly linked to the Dawlish situation, wouldn't it be a good idea to reopen that line? It was reopened. And we're now seeing the benefits of having that connectivity, Oakhampton to Exeter again, and the economic benefits that's bringing. And so a sort of reversal of previous cuts, and it maybe shows that we just need to sort of relearn things that have been done in the past. But yeah, it's about people being able to get to places of work and education, healthcare and other services. And these things just inherently improve people's lives and circumstances and the economy.
So Peter, Gravity is potentially a transformational project for the region. The development of green technologies and bringing a much larger workforce to Bridgewater. Tell us a bit more about the project.
Yeah, it is clearly a transformational project. I went to an IC Taunton talk about it, one of Alicia's colleagues from Santec talking about it, which was really interesting. It's really well timed, can I just say initially, because Hinkley Point C, which everyone has heard about, there's the build program there at the moment. But of course, once the building of Hinkley Point is complete, it's, you know, the workforce is going to contract significantly. There's not, you know, obviously the massive long-term employment prospects that the construction has provided. So, you know, what's going to fill the gap? And the Southwest and towns in the Southwest has suffered from things like change of industries and disappearing infrastructure requirements. Bridgewater is such a case in point. It lost its port. It was one of the top 10 ports in the country at one point. It had a massive brick industry. That's all vanished. So, you know, characterizes those Southwest challenges. But what's happened, Hinkley Point is happening as well. And then shortly on, hot on the heels, will be Gravity, where near to Bridgewater, there's this transformational development, green technologies, tackling inequality with various social efforts, which I know Alicia can talk about better than me, but taking transport, which I'm passionate about, you know, we've got good accessible transport links, active travel opportunities from Bridgewater to the nearby site. So yeah, a really good exemplar, I think, for the way to go, perhaps in the Southwest.
From a social sustainability side, Gravity is very strong in terms of the connections with local universities. So they've got partnerships with Bath, Exeter, for example. They're doing a lot of work with local communities in terms of local community centres and activities to get the local community buy-in. They're doing a lot of STEM work as well, things like art competitions with local schools. And they've also developed sustainable skills and business charters, embedding sustainability within all the local businesses and trades and future tenants as well, just embedding sustainability across all their organisations.
And Peter, if you had the opportunity to ask our leaders one question to try and address the issues, you know, that ask for help, what would you ask of them?
I'd ask them to help empower the professional sector, all the sectors that are involved in infrastructure, to do more and work more effectively together and to join the dots as well. I mean, we've talked about a whole range of different things, digital connectivity, public toilets, trains. None of these infrastructure items or services or interventions need to be considered in isolation. Usually these things are location-based, you know, everything's place-based, isn't it? You know, if we had more joined-up thinking, opportunities were mapped, and professionals had sanction to work together to maximize benefits, and you maybe had health, transport, education work being done in concert, then everyone knows that teams tend to achieve more than individuals. You know, it wouldn't be great if we could prompt and sponsor teamwork and join the dots a lot more.
And Alicia, in terms of our project proposals and the development of our teams when we're designing infrastructure, I wonder, do you think proper time and effort goes into considering equality, or is that being overshadowed by the environmental agenda?
I don't think we use the Equality Act as much as we should. I think it's an incredibly powerful act. And I think sometimes we fall back on making assumptions in our mitigation and our solutions because it's tried and tested from another project. And I don't think we're necessarily going to the communities or the groups of people really impacted to actually ask them the questions. And I know that a lot of it is sort of put yourself in someone else's shoes and think about the project from their perspective. But we also need to understand their perspective to be able to do that. So I think potentially the environmental is coming ahead of equalities, but I think there's also a misunderstanding. I think somewhere they have been split and dealt as two different issues. But I think we've got to link them back again, because if there's an environmental impact, it's going to have an equality impact. And I don't think that understanding is as apparent in our project meetings.
So work to do and perhaps a challenge for us all. So Peter, Alicia, I'm going to come to you both now. And I'd like just one short way that we can do something as an industry to address inequality. So Alicia, you're first.
Use the data, see what it's not telling us, and go and ask those people who are not represented about what they need and want.
Fantastic. And Peter, what can we do as an industry to help make change?
I think we need to be more joined up. We need to speak to each other and speak to professionals from different sectors and usually different opportunities. If we can bring those together and maximize them, there are some big strategic opportunities around, but we need to join up the smaller opportunities as well so they have a bigger impact.
Fantastic. Well, a huge thank you to my guests today, Peter Radford, Associate Director of Turner & Townsend Infrastructure, and Alicia de Haldevang, Sustainability and Equalities Principal Consultant at Stantec. It's been such a great discussion, and we look forward to welcoming you back. Thanks to our listeners, of course. You've been listening to Beyond Brunel, and please join us again soon.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.